Good morning. Whatever is happening for you this morning, I hope that your sitting is nourishing at some level. So, today I'm going to talk about the third paramita, Kshanti in Sanskrit, Kanti in Pali, which is often translated as patience. Now, for me, this is the most humbling of the paramitas. So in many ways, I wrote this talk to myself. So this is the kind of direct translation. And I like to play with terms a little bit in the beginning so we kind of know what we're talking about. The direct translation of the word is often unaffected by or able to withstand. And Pali scholars say that it's most paired actually with metta or loving kindness. So we actually see Kanti metta a lot in the early, in the Pali scriptures. When ka, or ksha in Sanskrit, when it functions as a root, has the flavor of void or empty, or space or sky, which is the same for the word like upekka, which we translate as equanimity, that ka is at the end. So this unaffected by or this able to withstand has this character of spaciousness and accepting, not a rigidness, not a rigid bearing of something, not that kind of patience. Now, one of my favorite things I stumbled across is apparently this, I like to have a visceral sense of words to the degree that I can. And one thing I stumbled across yesterday is apparently this same word is often used to describe elephants. So I just imagine that kind of slow, imperturbable grace of an elephant body. I think it starts to give us a flavor of what we mean by kshanti. So we often translate it as patience, sometimes forbearance, sometimes forgiveness, gentleness, acceptance. And patience, the neat thing about the word patience is that it comes from the same root, pati, as passion does. So that root means to endure suffering. We don't think of passion so much that way today because we have a society that kind of valorizes the first 6 weeks of a relationship. But when you actually you actually look at that process a little bit, maybe suffering is a little closer. But, so on one side we have passion, which is the experience of suffering, and then on the other side, patience, which is more the still being with the suffering. Now, of course, that shares the same root with compassion, which literally means being with suffering. So there's a little bit of a kind of an etymological synonym there between patience and compassion, but maybe the difference, and we'll all have to feel this through for ourselves, but maybe the difference is that patience is that stillness that is able to be with the arising of suffering, and compassion is that movement toward relieving it. It meets it in a different way. It actually needs to meet it. So patience is critical. It's a critical paramita. In fact, Shantideva devoted an entire chapter just to patience, which I think is the only paramita he devoted an entire chapter to. But he clearly says that there's no spiritual practice equal to it of any kind, and that the bodhisattva should be focused on patience always. And he gives lots of examples like even when you're being ripped apart, you should be patient. And he's got a very high bar. But so when I was younger and I was studying anthropology, I was very much influenced by the work of Catherine Lutz. And what she worked on was basically emotional translation across cultures. And the thing that was interesting to me about her work is that she made it very clear that when we translate words, like in this case, we're translating patience for Kshanti. She worked particularly on emotional words, like what do we mean by love versus what a Micronesian person might mean by a different word in their language. And what was important was that these words, of course, point to whole fields, to whole contexts that we grow up in, that we embody. And that this one-to-one relationship between words doesn't, you know, there might be some overlapping of those fields in the different cultures, but they're not, there's no one-to-one relationship, and there will never be a one-to-one relationship. And so, even though I'm not by any means a scholar in this area, I like to look into the sense of the word in its original, so that we can start getting a sense of that context. But not just only for its own sake, you know, this way that Lutz talks about it takes time. We can't just have a quick translation. It requires a certain depth and openness and love, curiosity. And not just in translating emotions, and not just in study is this important, but actually this way of understanding it translates into every relationship we will ever have and have ever had. And through this process, this understanding of that the translation may not be exactly what we think it is, that we might be dealing with a world or a context that we don't particularly understand in another human being or in another culture. A few things. One is it's the meeting that illuminates both sides, that gives us a sense of the truth coming out of that meeting. But also, patience is required for that process. For that truth to unfold, a profound amount of patience is required. A bodhisattva in that situation learns to listen, learns to be non-reactive. Explores the relationship of those two universes, as opposed to kind of, you know, before we take that vow up, we're more living a life of forcing our ideas onto a mystery rather than being in the world. So that may be true of ourselves as well. We might be sitting here today and we're quietly exploring, and we may think we have an idea of what we are. And that language may be really worked out. And yet, if we sit for a while without throwing those words on what's actually happening, we may discover that there are undiscovered territories that are emerging. That if we don't smother them with our ideas of what we are, we actually start to know ourselves. So we sit down and we commit to this stillness. For a while. And so for me, I feel like when I'm thinking of bodhisattva and this process, we approach study and practice and sitting meditation and our relationships and ourself with the same openness, with the same kind of exploration. And knowing that the words miss the mark, that they're never going to quite touch what's happening, we might, although I am quite bad at this, we might be patient with the way we use them. We might recognize that they are in fact limited. We might be patient with the way others use them, and that they don't necessarily understand the limits of those words. This is one reason we always talk about that we can't fix anything, because this language-based understanding kind of has no idea what's really going on. You know, we live from that, but it really isn't paying attention in a particular way. So if that's the source of our knowing, then we're a little clunky in the way we move through the world. So instead, we learn to be present and patient with shifting fields of ourselves, other people, of what unfolds. So on one side, we have Shanti the elephant, the spacious mind unaffected by the activity of mind and life, and paired with loving kindness. And on the other side, we have patience, the ability to remain unmoved with suffering, our own and others. And both of these, where their fields overlap, is that they point to a stillness of mind associated with being present with suffering. So when we're talking about this paramita, we're talking about that stillness of mind. What struck me in all of this is that there is so much effort that goes into just having a fair translation of a single word. And I toss thousands around all day as if I am positively sure what I'm talking about. I think of my relationship with Laura as if I actually know who she is and I can offer some sort of advice. But that busy mind of words doesn't really know what's best. And all that I have is actually my vow not to do harm and my vow to serve awakening and a vow to live for the benefit of all beings. That's what I have. If I even have that. So this not knowing, this mystery, is kind of the field of patience. This is where patience lives. It's a field where intellect struggles, but I think the heart thrives. Because when patience is there, in my experience, the heart is actually free to come forward. It's not being doused by a bunch of ideas of what should be happening. It's not being kind of, language I always use, it doesn't have this scaffolding of our beliefs around it. We don't have to suffer under the clamoring of our mind about what is the best thing to do next. And when I talk about, you know, my sensation in the body, one thing that struck me when I was feeling this through before was that in that situation, I really am talking about patience, because I don't have a bodily experience of Kshanti. It's not my language. It's not what I grew up in. It informs me. I can intellectualize it. I can translate. I can guess, but it isn't my world. But patience, that's in my muscles. That I can actually feel. And I say that because I think that it's important to live with our bodies in a way, at least it has been for me, where we begin to understand the contours of our mind and body in a very intimate way, where we understand what actually is our, you know, language. Not the one we've inherited and thrown on, but the one that actually is emergent when we sit and we listen and we're present. And these may not be words. They may be sensations. They may be tightnesses. They may be all kinds of things, but we get a sense of what's going on, what the field is. And it's actually through that process, in my experience, that we come to understand that the distinctions between your field, you and me, begin to kind of fall apart. So what is kshanti? What is this patience? It's not really an emotion. It's not really an activity. The term that I love is one that I heard Richard Baker and others use. It's a mental posture. It's a decision to take a mental posture in the same way that we take a physical posture. We take a posture of mind that is patience. So we sit upright, and our eyes are 45 degrees down, and our back is straight, and our legs are crossed, or in a chair. We find stability, buoyant stability in the legs, buoyancy in the torso. We tuck our chin, we line our nose up with our navel. All of the things that we've been taught to do, this is the posture we commit to. Patience is a posture in very much the same way. We might have a sense of it. Might be an internal stillness or a spaciousness or an upright tolerance, or we might have our own sense of what that is. And I think it's good to have a bodily sense because we know what we're returning to actually understand what the posture is for ourselves, so that it's not some intellectual word like, I'm not being patient, and we beat ourselves up or do whatever. No, but what is it to feel patience? What is it to take on the posture of patience? And then when that posture isn't present, we know that posture isn't present. In the same way, if we lean in zazen, we know we're leaning. And the two are very, as you probably know, the two are very intimately connected. Right? We sit upright in zazen and we choose not to move. Even though the mind's unleashing everything it can on us, we're going to sit and we're not going to do anything about it. We're not going to scratch an itch. We're not going to do whatever. If we're in severe pain, please move. But we're choosing not to move. And that process, Otia often uses the analogy of bouncing balls in a room that's growing in size. It's a great analogy. There's all these balls bouncing around, and the room gets more wider and wider, and the balls slow down. And what's neat about the ball slowing down and there being more space is that we start to actually be able to see the trajectory of the balls. We actually start being able to see even maybe why the balls are bouncing, what the balls are, what the root of the whole process is. And patience is that same in the way zazen traps that, traps us a little bit into being in a space where we let that unfold. Patience does the same thing for us. Oh, right now I am incredibly irritated. What is happening? I'm going to be still. With zazen, something else happens as well, not just seeing the balls bouncing, which is good and very important, and there are many ways to do it. But in a way, something, the balls are very personal, Whatever your set of balls are, your set of balls. But there's something that is not personal, and that happens as well, which is we start to be able to see the space in which the balls are bouncing. We start to notice that there is a mind there that is unflinching, that is not being affected by anything that's going on. And that what we call true mind, spacious, awake, what changes is over time, that mind begins to know itself. As that mind begins to know itself, then everything changes at that point because we're not caught up in the activity. We're not caught up with what's going on in the room. We're with the space. We're with the presence. And hopefully, little bit by little bit by little bit, our allegiance begins to shift from all of that busyness to that space. In my experience, the deepest patience comes from that place. It comes from, it's born of that that mind. So if we want to cultivate patience, we sit zazen. It's pretty, this is actually pretty easy. You know, well, I'm not saying that sitting zazen is easy, but if patience is something that we want to cultivate, sit still and let things happen and don't do anything about it. And you will cultivate patience. The patience that the busy mind has in mind is a really big should, usually. I should be patient. Should mind is great. You know, I should learn more languages. I should not eat chocolate. I should, you know, on and on and on and on. I should get all of my things that I want to do for myself done in the next 5 years, and I should be patient. You know, so. At least me, and maybe it's because restlessness is my major hindrance, I think. It doesn't really get patience, that mind. For me, my mind tends to spin and spin until it's kind of overworked and frustrated if I don't live from another place. But that conditioned mind believes it has the power to define reality. It really is quite sure that it has the power to define reality as it sees fit, and it will do whatever it can to make that so. And that particular conviction makes patience difficult. Because it's, well, for obvious reasons. You're doing a lot of work trying to make things the way you want them to be instead of being patient with what's unfolding. So there's a Buddhist teaching that kind of neutralizes this conviction. It's called Three Marks of Existence. People often do not find this a fun teaching. Be warned. So the first mark of existence is life is marked by suffering. Life is going to have the mark of dukkha. It's going to have the mark of disease. We want suffering to end. That is reasonable. And for me, you know, as an example, I think I was talking to somebody the other day who was says that sometimes when I talk about things like injustice, I have an edge, and it's true, and it's something that I am working with. And it's because I want injustice to end. I think it's stupid. You know, I want it to stop. And but that is not the teaching. The teaching is not that suffering is going to end tomorrow because my mind wants suffering to end. The teaching is that as long as there is human life born of the conditioned human mind, there is going to be suffering in the world, even if we personally wake up and leave that suffering behind. It's not about whether our personal suffering is going to end. It's about the mark of human existence. So if we can accept this to our marrow, we can be released from the impatience with the suffering of ourselves and other people. But this has to be really deeply accepted, and it's not particularly easy to accept. It's funny they put it first. I think it's actually the hardest one. Even the other ones are more, in a certain way, more complex concepts. I think this is the hardest to accept. And if we don't accept it, if we don't meet the First Noble Truth with this kind of clarity, our unconscious ingrained responses are likely going to deepen the suffering of our life even more. Because we're just going to shove it away and they're going to keep on going. Shantideva asks us to regard our suffering, even the most extreme, as insignificant, since doing so strengthens our mental composure. Not there yet. Geshe Sonam Rinchen asks us to regard our suffering as happiness, because each moment of suffering points us to our grasping and therefore is a doorway to our awakening. So when we are impatient with suffering, there's an opportunity for awakening. Accepting our suffering, being patient with it, increases both our courage and our capacity. And the second one is life is marked by impermanence. Now, this one is like super, oh, of course. Yeah. Intellectual acceptance of that is super easy. But we do want things and people that we love to remain. And sometimes we will do whatever we can, no matter how unreasonable, to make that happen. This can give rise to impatience and anger around trying to control our lives in a way that is not really going to work out, because everything that exists is going to cease to exist. And if we can accept that, then we are released from the need to hold back the natural trajectory of our lives. And the impatience around that control, the frustration and the anger goes away with it. So these are long, you know, these are long reflections on suffering and impermanence. For me, I recently had a very, yesterday, when I say recently, day before, teaching around this mark, because as many of you know, we're working out some labor issues here and figuring out how things are going to get done, and there's some fiscal stuff we have to pay attention to, and I don't necessarily know how this is going to happen. And part of my conditioning when these things happen is to do a lot more. And that got to a point where it caused me a good deal of suffering, and frustration, and even anger. But it was a good teaching, because what came out of it when I was looking at it was what is going on. And what was going on was that I could not accept, I had an idea of how things should unfold. And that idea of how things should unfold is that Brooklyn Zen Center should continue under all circumstances. And that's what should happen. And there was a part of my mind that would not accept the possibility that it might not be figured out and that this place would not exist. And so once it did, then my mind totally relaxed. It was fine. Now, I went through a little period of time where I accepted it intellectually, but I was still having emotion, so I clearly was not accepting it. I was like, oh yeah, I'm fine with it not existing, and I'm annoyed. but then once that acceptance did happen, that fell away. So that for me was a really powerful example of really everything has to be given over to the truth. You know, there isn't anything that we're allowed to reserve for a special shelf. Everything gets given over to the truth. And it doesn't mean that I don't want this place to continue and that I don't want to keep sitting and meeting with the people that I care about. Of course I want that. But it has to be given over to the truth. So the third is that life is marked with no self. The human mind seems to fairly commonly want things to have a core that we can rely on, There is something there that I can rely on. It is permanent, it is separate from me, and it better stay put. And this is especially true, I think, of people. You know, we want our husbands and our wives and our parents and everyone to be there. We don't want this, you know, flux. This is a lot like wanting the word we're speaking to be a one-to-one relationship with what's going on. It's just not. You know, we want there to be something that sums up the person. We like solid sidewalks that we can walk over and not rivers we have to wade through. So we reduce each other, we reduce ourselves to these very predictable cores. At least we think. But the teaching is that there is no such permanent, separate core of self existing anywhere in anything, ever. Including us. Including the thing that we think is looking out of our eyes right now. And this one, if we can accept this, then we're released from a compulsion to really make the world in the image of our own projections. And there is an impatience and fear that rises when we're doing that and nothing is complying. So not accepting the three marks, not accepting life as it is, underlies this impatience and frustration pretty generally. It's one way to come at it. There are many. Alternatively, when the mind accepts life as it is, we open, we relax. The mind opens, the mind relax, and when it is open, when we talked about before, we talk about a lot here, the heart's able to come forward. It's not fettered at that point. And this is the thing, there's this, my intellect's need to control is a deep lack of faith in that I'm already built to respond. I don't need to do anything. You know, I'm built, my heart is built to respond to suffering. I don't have to control the world so that suffering doesn't happen. And we can, of course, bring all of this to ourselves. We can respond to our conditioned mind in a way that doesn't expect it to be permanent or ongoing, that doesn't need it to have a core, that accepts its suffering, that doesn't need to clean that suffering up, that doesn't need to make it better. Because with the Bodhisattva, that's what we take care of. You know, we don't try to obliterate the suffering. We don't try to get rid of the conditioned mind. We actually need it. But the way I like to think of it is, it's like a child in a corner playing with toys, thinking that its own little imaginary universe is the limits of reality. Now that's just dear. You know. Much better than you need to clean up your room, which is kind of the way we go at our mind. So I want to talk about three traditional reflections on this to help with impatience, because those three marks are they're kind of a lifelong practice, but all of it is. But these are three things that are very traditional in terms of dealing with impatience specifically. And I recently read them together. I've heard them in different places, but I recently read them together. And this is what they are. Instead of responding with impatience and anger to a situation, okay, we might reflect on how our past actions and our current responses are contributing to the suffering that we're experiencing right now. So that's one reflection. So we're standing in line and we're frustrated. Instead of going that way, we say this all the time, instead of going that way, we go this way. Okay, so that's one reflection. This next reflection is to reflect on that the person who's treating us unjustly or with malice is actually at that moment a teacher around this particular paramita, around patience. I always laugh because there's a part of my mind that hates this teaching, you know. But my experience knows that it is profoundly healing. And so it is one to stay committed to, although it is not an easy one. And then the third shares a lot with the third mark. It's reflecting on the teaching of dependent co-arising. And really in a simple way, that the actions of the person facing me right now, whether it be me or someone else, is a result of countless conditions. And so am I and my response. So there is no permanent independent self to blame, and there is no permanent independent self being harmed. When the mind knows itself in this way, really insult has nowhere to land. There isn't a point, there isn't that person, there isn't someone there for that insult, or that action or whatever, it has nowhere to land. And so when that's the case, we can see in a way that we couldn't see before, which is not I'm currently impatient with this person who has insulted me, but here is a mind that is in so much pain that it had to leak all over me and actually increase its suffering even further. That is what's happening. And the difference between those two worlds is whether there's a you there getting hit or there's not. Shanti Davis says, he wrote that, he has a lot to say on patience, that's why he keeps coming up. Shanti Davis says that impatience and anger towards someone who has been conditioned negatively is as inappropriate as it would be toward fire for its nature to burn. Atiyah always says, if they could do better, they would. But they aren't, so they can't. They are the summation, we are the summation of our conditioning. And something else that is aware of all that conditioning. But until that's really clarified, conditioning kind of runs the show. So the Bodhisattva's job is to take care of this mind patiently. We will never have another human mind, another set of conditions, another life to take care of. This is the one. We don't get to trade it out. So I think the sooner that we can stop having the discussion with ourselves that it needs to be some other life, that we can actually be with the one that's here in a kind, compassionate, patient way, with curiosity, with love, without defining a bunch of words and telling us how to be. And I think the happier we'll end up. Forget about happy, liberated, free, whether we're happy or not. So we practice presence with that mind. The awake mind accepts, the liberated heart responds. So as bodhisattvas, this can be our healing intention. This patience can be our healing intention. This can be our mental posture that we practice. I feel like this is what Zazen makes possible, what our sitting meditation makes possible, what being here today together makes possible. Actually supporting each other in patience practice, supporting each other in sitting practice, supporting each other in stillness. There's not much more to say. This is our way. I feel this is our way. This is the life of a bodhisattva who's devoted to the liberation of everything. And I hope we take it up. I vow to keep taking it up, even though I am quite confident I am going to fail on a daily basis. But I hope for myself and all of us that we can greet those failures as our greatest teachers, not as something wrong with us. I look forward to taking this up together and continuing our practice, and thank you for being here. May our intention.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by the Brooklyn Zen Center. Our programs are given free of charge and made possible by the donations we receive. For more information on supporting Brooklyn Zen Center, please visit the giving section of brooklynzen.org.